In previous talks, we've been discussing the fact that radiation can activate kinases, and this leads to signaling mechanisms which can affect intrinsic radiation sensitivity and resistance of cells. This, of course, will be impacted by changes in oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes which cause cancer. Therefore, it's important to consider what pathways have been activated within cancer cells whenever it comes to thinking about how they respond to radiation. Signaling has evolved to allow signal cells to respond to the extracellular environment. It really has become very sophisticated as the result of the need for cells to communicate within tissues and between tissues. There are various types of signals that exist within nature. Some of these are microenvironmental, both physiological and pathological. Others are internal homeostatic signals, such as the response to DNA damage. Most signals, in particular those between cells, are sent through ligand binding to receptors on the cell surface. This allows multiple extracellular stimuli to be distinguished from each other. This form of signaling is particularly important in terms of cell survival and cell-cell communication. In the overall scheme of things, multiple signaling pathways have to be integrated in order for a cell to make a response. And generally, this is said through receptors which are activated, and this leads to transcription, translation, and production of new proteins in response to these signals. It's important to realize that radiation is a signal. In other words, it does activate the signal transduction pathways, and the signal transduction pathways they activate in order to make a response also have to be integrated within the multiple signals that the cell is receiving. Whenever one looks at the interaction of ligands with receptors, the first step is ligand-induced oligomerization in order to activate the receptors. This simply means that receptors are brought close to each other, and it's this process that leads to receptor kinases being activated and conformational changes or conformational changes which occur within the receptor, which allow adapter proteins to bind, and these may be what in some circumstances activate the kinase pathways. It's also important to realize that many of these receptors can actually co-associate with each other and with other receptors or similar receptors on the cell surface. And for example, ERBB1 and ERBB3 can actually interact together to activate downstream pathways. What happens whenever these signal pathways are activated is you get activation of transcription. And this is obviously a very important kind of step in making a response to the stimuli. However, there are other events that can take place as well. For example, you get post-transcriptional stabilization of messenger RNA. There are regions within the untranslated region of mRNA, the AU-rich regions as they're called, which are particularly important in stabilizing mRNA. There are also translational control mechanisms that can operate, as well as post-translational mechanisms which lead to protein stabilization or destabilization. This is normally through the addition of obviously phosphor groups or ubiquitin groups or acetyl groups and so on. And also what goes on is the alteration in the rate at which protein is degraded. And this is really an important aspect of making very rapid responses to stimuli. And again, these are kind of mechanisms. All of these mechanisms can actually be activated by radiation. So radiation works at many different levels within the cell. It's also the expression of genes and proteins. The major players within cell signaling pathways are obviously kinases, and the tyrosine kinases, serine-threonine kinases, and dual specificity kinases exist. And these pathways are controlled in part by the action of phosphatases, which can remove phosphate groups and therefore control the level of phosphorylation of various molecules within a cell. We've already talked about one of these, which is CDC25, which is important in removing phosphate groups in order to activate cyclin-dependent kinases. There are many examples of receptors which have kinase activity built into them. The most important of these are the epidermal growth factor receptor family, the fibroblast growth factor receptor, platelet-derived growth, and insulin growth factor receptor family. The importance of these in radiation oncology is that these serve as targets for anti-cancer therapies, and which can therefore modify radiation responsiveness. So phosphorylation as a process has many effects depending upon what molecule is phosphorylated. It can alter the activity of enzymes, initiating various cascades, for example the MAP kinase pathway is a cascade which is activated by EGFR autophosphorylation. There are other phosphorylation events that can activate molecules to bind to DNA, for example, STAT. There are phosphorylation events that will alter the subcellular localization of proteins, and many that will alter the protein stability. Whenever one thinks of the features of carcinogenesis, maybe many of the changes which are associated with carcinogenesis really deal with molecular signaling. This is, if you like, the hallmark of cancer, that there are various kind of pathways which are affected by mutations which lead to cancer. And these can lead to, for example, self-sufficiency in growth factor signaling, loss of responsiveness to either ligand or activation of receptors without ligand binding. Another possibility is a loss of response to anti-proliferative signals which come into the cell, or evasion of programmed cell death mechanisms. Increased replicative potential of cells as a result of telomerase changes, alterations which promote tissue invasion, metastasis, that sustain angiogenesis, and also DNA repair abnormalities and genomic instability. All of these potential mechanisms go together to result in a decrease in the cell loss factor. Under normal circumstances, of course, the cell loss factor in a steady state tissue is 1. Whenever you decrease the cell loss factor, that becomes less than 1, and you get a growth. So there are these potential mechanisms all result in a growth change within a tissue. Some of the most important kind of aspects of carcinogenesis, because of these signaling pathway changes, mean that the tumor cells essentially become addicted to the function of specific mutations within them, and the pathways that they need for existing. This is good news because actually these then are critical molecules that can be targeted. The bad news is that mutation rates are higher, and this also often allows variants to escape, which is a problem. It's important to realize that although the steady state of tissue cells is disturbed so that you get growth, there is still a lot of cell loss going on. Whenever it comes to targeting, this means that in fact probably the most important population of cells within a cancer are actually the stem cells, which may be a small minority of the overall population. And if targeted therapies are going to be of any value, then it's important that this population is included as a target population. It follows also that rapid tumor regression might not mean very much if you get non-stem cell populations being involved. Basically, there are two major types of mutations that can take place in cancer. One deals with oncogenes, the other deals with tumor suppressor genes. The first oncogene was discovered in 1970, and it was an interesting kind of history because they were found to be associated with retroviruses. It wasn't until 1976 that Bishop and Varmus noted that, in fact, these oncogenes were actually just being carried by the retrovirus and were, in fact, self-genes. And the retrovirus was inserting them in the wrong position within the cell. And so this kind of came to be known as the concept that there was an enemy within the cell, and that essentially oncogenes were defective proto-oncogenes, which were normal genes. We think of oncogenes as having what is called driver mutations. In other words, they cause a gain in function. And the kind of classes, again, that we talk about in terms of oncogenes are described in this slide on oncogenes. And the way in which they gain function is really through multiple kind of processes, whether it be deletion of bits of the gene, point mutations, translocation events, gene amplification events. All of these are very common mechanisms whereby oncogenes can be activated. Moving on to a really classic example of a translocation, this is the Philadelphia chromosome, which was discovered in 1960, which is the hallmark of CML, though it also exists in certain cases of AML as well. Essentially, what happens here is that the BCR gene and the ABL gene come together and to form the BCR-ABL translocation. And this means that you get activation of the ABL gene in a constitutive fashion, which leads to cell cycling. Targeting this mutation has been shown to be possible using the drug Gleevec, which inhibits proliferation of CML cells by binding to the ATB binding site in the kinase domain of ABL. Again, this is a very specific kind of mutation. It's a very good target for biological therapies. However, even in this disease, there is relapse as a result of outgrowth of leukemic subclones that are resistant to the BCR ABL mutations. And there are other drugs now which are available which you can be used to treat Gleevec-resistant CML. Another mechanism of oncogenic activation is exemplified by c-MYC. And c-MYC has, again, a chromosomal translocation can increase c-MYC transcriptional activity. On the other hand, c-MYC can also be amplified, and this is found in many different types of human tumor. or you can be activated by point mutations. So there are various ways in which c-MYC can be deregulated. But it's a very common target in cancer carcinogenesis. The next couple of slides just show you some examples of c-MYC translocations, in particular in Burkitt's lymphoma, which is a fairly classic translocation. And it's also there are also translocations that occur in multiple myeloma. The important issue here is that these translocations largely are translocations which include c-MYC becoming associated with immunoglobulin enhancer regions, and it's this association which leads to c-MYC being produced in high quantities. And instead, the second class of mutations that are associated with cancer involve tumor suppressor genes. And tumor suppressor genes are different from oncogenes in the sense that they really are the brakes that protect cells from carcinogenesis. Knudsen was the first to propose that loss of both alleles for retinoblastoma was important in order to develop certain types of cancer. And for, in general, most tumor suppressor genes require loss of both alleles, though this isn't totally true. But it does, it is an important kind of concept because hereditary diseases often have are heterozygous with respect to a particular tumor suppressor gene. And whenever the child is born with this mutation, then there's obviously only one allele that needs to be knocked out in order for the cancer to develop. And so it tends to be a very early onset cancer. Whereas non-hereditary retinoblastoma is something which can occur really rather later in development. There are many important tumor suppressor genes which are known. These loss of function mutations include genes coding for phosphatases, transcription factors like P53, repair genes, cell cycle inhibitors like RB, and genes which are important in terms of inducing apoptosis. So loss of these will lead to lack of cell cycle arrest, decreased apoptosis, increased metastatic propensity. It's important to realize that any single mutation is normally totally insufficient to cause cancer. One needs multiple mutations for this to occur. This notion was first developed by looking at the age distribution of cancers. The fact that cancer frequency increases with age suggests that you need multiple mutations to take place. Most oncogenes can induce both growth and apoptosis as well, which indicates that transformation requires more than one mutation, and that often you get a cooperation between oncogenes, for example, one that enhances cell growth, another that inhibits cell death, often go together, such as RAS, P16, MYC, RAS. The validation of this experimentally was really done by Weinberg, looking at the expression of c-MYC and RAS mutations, and essentially what the outcome of this experiment was that both of these were very effective in driving transformation. However, either alone was not terribly effective. So this was really the validation that you needed more than one hit in order for cancer to develop. As far as radiation is concerned, there were some early studies which were done showing that whenever you had cells which are transformed by both RAS and MYC, then one ended up with radiation resistance. Qixin Chang and others in our group have looked at a number of genes which put into RAT1 cells leads to their increased radiation resistance. Should be noted this is not necessarily associated with transformation per se. These changes in radiation response are really related to the signal transduction pathways that are activated, rather than the fact that they go on to produce cancer. The concept that there was a multi-step process in cancer induction was probably best formulated by Bert Vogelstein back in 1988, where he looked at the genetic alterations in human cancers and came up with a stepwise process by which normal epithelium would go through adenocarcinoma towards a highly malignant phenotype. And he noticed there were multiple changes that were required in order for this to happen. In the New England Journal of Medicine paper, in fact, these are well described. The slide actually shows a kind of more up-to-date version of many of these changes. Some of the most important changes associated with cancer result in molecules that can be targeted using biological approaches. One of these is obviously the epidermal growth factor receptor. And this is mutated or activated abnormally in many cancers, in many different cell types. One of the classic examples is glioblastoma multiforme, where you get multiple changes taking place, but the change from grade 3 to grade 4 GBM is associated in part with EGFR amplification or mutation. And about 40% of glioblastomas show amplification, and about half of these also express a mutant receptor, which is the EGFR V3 receptor. What has happened in this case is that there is a truncation within the receptor which removes the ligand binding domain, and the rest of the molecule becomes constitutively active. There are other changes, of course, which are associated with glioblastoma. And one of the important molecules here is P10, which is a phosphatase, which is downstream of the EGFR pathway. This is an important kind of concept because if one looks at a simplified map of how EGFR signals can do this in several different important pathways are downstream of it. One is through GRAB2, which will lead to RAS activation, RAF, and MAP kinase, ERK signaling. Another is through PI3 kinase. And the PI3 kinase pathway involves P10, which is an important molecule in terms of activating ACT. ACT downstream pathways involve a variety of important molecules which are involved in cell death, survival, cell cycle arrest, DNA repair, and also cellular metabolism. So essentially, it's not only a question of EGFR being important here, but if you have mutations downstream of EGFR, then these also can impact any kind of potential targeting strategies. important mutations are, for example, in RAS mutation or in loss of P10. The RAS oncogenic mutations are one of the most common mutations in human cancers, and it really just shows the importance of this pathway as downstream of receptor tyrosine kinases. In essence, there are a couple of different mutations which are common, but both stabilize the GTP bound form of RAS. And this GTP binding is important in the activation of the MAP kinase pathway, which leads to cell proliferation and cell survival. So if RAS is mutated, this pathway is on the whole time. This just shows the importance of RAS mutations in multiple different types of cancers. And the other kind of aspect of the downstream pathways of receptor tyrosine kinases involves P10, which is a tumor suppressor gene. And again, it's possible to see from this slide just how common P10 mutations are. P10 can also be silenced by gene methylation, and this is a fairly common mechanism in addition to just loss of activity. We already mentioned before the retinoblastoma gene, and it's clearly a very important gene for cell cycle. Whenever it gets phosphorylated, it releases E2F, which is important in terms of activation of the genes necessary for S phase progression. Mutations in retinoblastoma are common not only in retinoblastoma itself, but in many other different types of cancers. And obviously, mutations in retinoblastoma mean that this E2F pathway is always on. Probably the most famous tumor suppressor gene is P53. It has multiple activities. X is a transcription factor, also binds to double strand breaks in DNA. It's degraded through an MDM2 E3 ligase pathway, mutated in more than 50% of human cancers, and from a radiation perspective, P53 is activated through ATM and DNA PK to produce P21 and Bex, which is important in cell cycle arrest and apoptosis. It follows that P53 knockout mice are sensitive to DNA damage and they have a high incidence of tumors. And P53 mutated tumors are generally more aggressive and are more radiation resistant. It's possible to target P53 loss or mutation using gene therapy approaches. So the SCOV ovarian cancer cell line, SCOV3, if one puts in P53, it becomes more radiation sensitive, and if you use an adenoviral P53 vector in order to put P53 or express P53 in the SCOV tumors, then if you combine this with radiation, you can see quite a dramatic effect of reintroducing P53. So again, one can see the link between the DNA repair pathway, the cell cycle pathway, and cell death and survival, and how oncogenic signaling pathways are important in terms of affecting these mechanisms within the cell. And it's inevitable that these mutations will alter radiation responsiveness. The real issue here is to try and if you're going to target cancer with the idea of altering these signal transduction pathways, then it's important to realize that these are the same signal transduction pathways that determine intrinsic cellular radiation sensitivity. The rules generally are that if you activate cell survival or cell cycle progression pathways, then you're going to end up with a more radiation-resistant tumor. And if you activate pro-apoptotic or cell cycle arrest pathways, then these are going to become generally more radiation sensitive. So in summary, the intrinsic radiation resistance is driven in part by genetically determined signal transduction pathways, and cancer-associated mutations will affect these responses. It also follows that the DNA damage responses can actually be activated under certain circumstances by oncogenic changes. And there's obviously another level, a very strong link between DNA repair defects and cancer. All of this leads one to think that hopefully one day we might have the ability to stage cancer at the molecular level, and in doing so, come up with a rationale for being able to predict whether a cancer is radiation sensitive or radiation resistant. This is obviously a very important concept if we're going to tailor cancer therapies to the individual patient. We need to develop predictive biomarkers which will help us in terms of what to treat or what not to treat, perhaps just as importantly. And also pharmacodynamic biomarkers, which will allow one to look at, for example, cell cycle proliferation of a cancer in order to be able to determine what the best dose and schedule is. There are a large number of techniques which are being explored with respect to coming up with predictive and pharmacodynamic markers. Some of these involve mass screening kind of approaches. Others are rather more specific in the way they're used. At this point in time, exactly the best mechanism is not terribly clear, but what is clear is that it is possible to use some of these techniques to identify different types of cancers in a way which is really very distinct from the common pathology approach. This can be exemplified by looking at the gene microarray kind of technique, which takes normal and tumor cells and looks for overexpression of various genes. The concept being that if you can define a prognosis classifier, then this can be applied to all human genes of a particular cancer. So in lung cancer, it's been known for many years that you get different groups of adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, small cell and large cell all kind of fall out. And the differences between group 1, 2, and 3 adenos is really quite clear in terms of survival. It's also a lot of effort going into classifying sensitive and resistant cancers. Here's an example of gene profiling, which is applied to cervical cancer, showing that there are differences between radiation sensitive and resistant cell lines with respect to the expression of various genes. Finally, although I've really talked about oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes from the point of view of mutations, it should be remembered that there are cancers which viruses have been heavily associated with in terms of their etiology. In fact, p53 was isolated because of its involvement in viral infection with SV40. because large T antigen abrogates normal p53 function. And proteins that disrupt p53 function are often required by many viral genomes in order to allow them to proliferate. Because if wild-type p53 is there, then the cell tendency is to die. By the same token, proteins like retinoblastoma protein are targeted by viral oncoproteins like SB40 large T or human papillomavirus E7, resulting in increased cell cycle progression and transformation. So there are a number of viruses which are extremely important in different types of cancers. This, of course, again provides targets, possible targets for intervention. It's going to be interesting to see in the future just how important targeting, in particular, human papillomavirus is going to be, in particular with respect to prevention of cancer such as cervical cancer.